So here we go. We're going to be learning essentially a new topic altogether, and that is the last three chapters, the last three prakim of Melachim Aleph. That is Perek Chof, Chof Aleph, and Chof Beis. And most people are not aware of this section in Tanakh at all, because it falls between two very famous episodes. The episode number one is Eliyahu at Har Carmel, and that whole surrounding episode that we just finished learning. And the next one is Eliyahu and Elisha, and the ascent of Eliyahu to heaven, which is the beginning of Melachim Beis. And the last three chapters of Melachim Aleph, generally speaking, don't get so much press or time or attention, which is why it's so important for us to pay extra special attention and try to appreciate what's going on here. And the focus of this section is going to be somewhat interesting, because we're focusing on a very complex character. Here we have a man by the name of Achav, who's the king of Israel. And we've seen by all standards that he is not simple. You know, on the one hand, he seems to be convinced by Eliyahu's Har Carmel. On the other hand, he's married to Jezebel. He's brought Baal worship into the land of Israel. He seems to be a complex fellow. How does this all work together? How do we square this? How does Hashem relate to him? Is part of the questions that we're going to be spending a little time learning a little bit about in the next few minutes. So our focus today, our mission for today, is to focus on the first half of Perek Chof, the 20th chapter of Sefer Melachim Aleph. I would have loved to have done all of it in one shot, but as you'll see, it's just it's a complex time, and there's a lot of details. I prefer to sort of appreciate each set of details by itself. So let's start at the very beginning, which is discussing the first issue, which is trouble from the north. So let's look at this together. So we're told the following really interesting story now that happens, and that is during the reign of Achav. So Achav is the king, everything seems to be settling down, and now we have problems in the north. So we have the following. We're told in the Psukim Aleph to Gimel, Ben Hadad, that's the name of Melech Aram, of the king of Aram. Kovatz es kol cheloi, he gathered all his armies, Ushloshim Ushnai Melech Itoi, and 32 other kings who were with him. That doesn't mean kings of countries, it means kings of cities or little areas. Usus v'rechev and much cavalry, Vayal v'yotzar al Shomron v'ilochem ba. And he ascended and he besieged Shomron and attacked it. Now, remember, Shomron is an area, but it's also the capital city of the area of Israel. So we call Shomron today the area Samaria. But it really, actually, in the times of Achav and Omri, was really the focal town, which was the capital city, which Omri changed when he became the king. And that being the case, so it sounds like this is really a fait accompli. They've already arrived at the city and are besieging it. The Mefarshim debate that, and they say maybe that is not true. Maybe, in fact, his intent is to besiege it, and he's on his way to besieging it, but it hasn't happened yet. So now he's marching with his hosts out to besiege Shomron. You see a similar thing, like that Barba Nel gives an example, when it says in the beginning of Parshas Vayetze, it says, Vayetze Yaakov mi Be'er Sheva, so Yaakov Avinu leaves Be'er Sheva and he goes to Haran. And then the whole first episode in that story, in the beginning of Vayetze, is what happens to Yaakov Avinu at Beis El or Yerushalayim, where he goes to sleep. Which means to say, even though it says Vayelech Haran, he went to Haran, it doesn't mean he arrived in Haran. It means he was intending to get there. Now let me tell you what happens along the way. Same thing here. It could be, as the Mevarshim say, they were on their way to Shomron to besiege it, and this is what happens. So he sends messengers to the city. It doesn't sound like he's saying please. It just sounds like he's making a statement. He says, your silver, your gold, your wives, your sons, the good ones, not the misbehaved ones, they're all mine. Okay, so he's basically, I lay claim to everything of value, relationships and assets of Achav. Okay, so let's just get a sense of the map quickly here. I want to skip ahead for a moment to the map. This is a very helpful map on page 3 at the top over here. It's just helpful to see this in relief here. So with the kingdom of Israel, of course, is in the north. It's a much larger kingdom in number and in area than the area of Judah in the south. And the sort of the border between them is around the top of the Dead Sea moving westwards. Now, the kingdom of Israel goes all up into the area of the Golan Heights, to the area of Dan, where the tribe of Dan is, and that's where the spring leads down to the Kinneret. And the whole area which we call today Syria is really the area of Aram. Okay, that's where this attack is coming from. The area where Lebanon is today is Phoenicia, which is actually an ally to Israel, as we've seen. Sidon and Tyre. We saw Hiram, the king of Tsor, was in a good, had a good relationship with Israel. The king of Sidon, Sidon, is Etbaal, whose daughter is Izebel. So there's good relations in the north, on the northwest side. On the northeast, this is where things are getting complex. Okay, so coming back to Absukim, so Ben-Hadad seems to be was actually not clear what he wants, but he's clearly making a demonstration of power. So let's go back a little bit in the history of this. I just want to trace this back a little bit in Nach to the times of David and Shlomo to appreciate who and why and what's going on here. So just to appreciate, when David Melech became king over all of Israel, not just Hebron in the 7 years at the beginning, but when he became king over all of Israel, he had a campaign which really expanded the borders of Israel to the north, to the north, the south, and the east. And in this battle, he has an example in Perek Ches in Shmuel Beis. We're told the following about about Damascus. So the king of Damascus came to aid the king of Aleppo. Sova is Aleppo. Vayach David Baram Esrimushnaim Elef Ish, and David Melech conquered or killed 22,000 soldiers. Vayosim David Nitzivim Baram Damesek Vatihi Aram David Lavadim Nosei Mincha Vayosha Hashem Es David B'chol Asher Holach. And David Melech conquered both these cities, and they now became tax paying, homage paying vassal states. And he takes these shields, these beautiful golden shields, and he brings them back to Jerusalem as a sign of his conquest of Aram. Okay, so in the end of the day, and we also talk about David pillaged a huge amount of copper or bronze from the cities of Betach and Berosai, which were the cities of Hadadezer. So David HaMelech gives a resounding conquest against Aram Damesek, which is coming to help Aram Tzava. Now, we move a little further into Perek Yud, and again, they don't seem to learn their lesson, but Aram comes again to the aid, not this time of Tzava, but to the aid of Ammon. So in Perek Yud in Sefer Shmuel, we're told, Vayugad David le-David, Vayesov is called Yisrael, Vayavores Yerden, Vayavoh Chelama, Vayarchu Aram likras David, Vayilach Amoimoy. David HaMelech now fights against Aram, who are mercenaries or allies to Ammon. Ammon's fighting Israel. David So he destroys the chariots, he kills the cavalry, he captures and kills the general Shovach. At which point they cut a peace deal, they pay homage to David, and they no longer decide to fight against Ammon. So for all intents and purposes, during the reign of David HaMelech, Aram has been quelled, right? So they are now essentially homage-paying vassal states. Okay. Now, as we go further into the times of Shlomo HaMelech, we're told about the great amount of wealth of Shlomo HaMelech, and in Melachim Aleph Perek Yud, we're told, V'chei nechol malchei achitim u'malchei Aram v'yadam yotziu. That Shlomo HaMelech could go wherever he wanted, demand whatever he wanted, including from the hands of Aram. So this relationship with Aram continues. Israel is on top. Aram is subsidiary. Until a little bit later on, when Shlomo HaMelech starts sinning, when Shlomo HaMelech's kingdom is not 100%, we now know that HaKadosh Baruch Hu sets up dissidents against him. So here are two dissidents we hear about. Okay. So number one is this person whose name is Hadad. That should ring a bell, because our person in the king of Aram now is Ben-Hadad. Is it the same person? That's an interesting question. But listen to the two dissidents that Hashem allows to find power. This is in Melachim Aleph, Perek Yud Aleph. Vayokem Hashem Satan Lishlomo, Eis Hadad Ha'adomi, Mizer HaMelech Hu Be'edom. So Hadad comes from Edomite blood in Edom. Vayhi biyos David es Edom. Vaylos Yoav sarat zavala kaberes hachalalim vayach kol zachar be'Edom. There's a campaign to eradicate all conscripted men, all army going men. Kisheshes chadashim yashav sham Yoav kol Yisrael adichirs kol zachar be'Edom. And they spent 6 months on this campaign. However, vayivrach Adad hu anashim adomim me'avdei aviv itoy lavo mitzrayim vaadad na'ar katon, and Adad escapes Edom and goes to Egypt. Egypt at this time is an ally of Israel, but nonetheless, he tries to seek refuge there. ויקומו מדיין, ויבואו פרעון, ויקחו אנשים ממוי מפרעון, ויבואו מצרים אל פרעון מלך מצרים, וייתן לבייס ולחם, אמר לה וארץ נעשנה. So the king of Egypt gives them food and board, he gives them a house, he gives them a little bit of territory, he obviously comes from royal blood, so he's treating him well. ויימצא הדד חן בעיני פרעון מאוד, and Paro liked Hadad a lot. So he gives him his sister-in-law as a wife. Wow, that's his wife's sister. So she bears him a son whose name is Genuvas. And this child grows up in the house of Pharaoh. And he grows up among the children of Pharaoh. So there's obviously a close relationship between this refugee Hadad and Paro in Egypt. So Hadad says, I want to return to my land once David HaMelech has died, because I know that this is now an opportunity to take revenge. Why are you leaving? I will give you everything you want. You need to send me. Okay, so that's Hadad. Hadad is this dissident. At the time of Shlomo HaMelech, he returns to create problems. And there's another one. His name is Razon. Who fled from Hadad Ezer, the king of Aleppo, Adonov. So then he took power in Damascus. Satan Yisrael called him Shlomo Vezara Asher Hadad. And then Hadad takes rule over the he was disgusted with Israel, and he became the ruler of Aram. So already we see that the sort of the roots of this anger, this roots of this displeasure with Israel, is already coming from earlier on. Why? The Tanakh is telling us not just politically but also spiritually. It's as a function of Shlomo Melech not doing what he should have done 100%. In that then the seeds are being planted for further problems. And now the problems are coming to full fruition. Now we start seeing that ultimately Hadad, or this is Ben-Hadad now, is now going to be leading the war effort against Ahav many generations later in the king of Israel. However, there's one critical episode that happens in between, which is also very important. And that is during the times of King Asa. Who's Asa? Asa is the son of Aviam. Aviam is the son of Rechavam. Rechavam is the son of Shlomo. So he is the great grandson of Shlomo HaMelech, and there at this point in time, the king in Israel, it's the second dynasty in Israel. First dynasty was Yerovam and Elah, and Nadav. Then it was Baasha. Baasha is the king in Israel. Asa is the king in Yehuda. By the way, it's not such a long period of time. We're talking about essentially at this point in time, this episode we're talking about is not more than 36 plus 9. So we're talking about 45 years after Shlomo, from the times of Shlomo HaMelech. So it's really not a long time from the beginning, mid-reign, 45 years from the end of Shlomo HaMelech. So it's really not a long period of time. And there's a war between Baasha and Asa. Baasha is the king of the north. Asa is the king of Yehuda. And what Baasha does is he sets up a tower, whether it be a tower to put snipers on top, whether it be a fortification to stop a border control. It's a very interesting discussion in the Mefarshim. But he sets up a town on the southern border of Israel, which is at the northern border of Yehuda. And Asa wants to stop this. He feels threatened by this. So what does Asa do? Asa does something which is really unforgivable, actually. Vayikach Asa, this is in Bemelachim Aleph Perek Tesvav. Vayikach Asa is kol hakesef azahav anasrim ba'otzras beis Hashem ve'otzras beis haMelech. Vayidne mi'ar avadav v'yishlachem l'melech Asa. El ben Hadad, ben Tavrimon, ben Chezion, ben Acharama, Yosheba, Damascus, Lemor. So what he does is he goes and he takes the all the gold and silver in his coffers and he sends them through a messenger round Israel all the way to the top. And he goes to Damascus and he says, Bris beni veinecho, ben avi, ben avicho, hine sholati lecho shoychad kesev azov. So he says, I'm giving you a bribe. He's not being very, euphemistic about this. He's cutting to the chase. So he says, Lecha Farta is Brischa is Baasha Melech Yisrael v'yalem Eolah. He says, look, me and my fathers, we met had a covenant between you. We all spoke the same language. We all am happy with each other. But you know what? This is a pretender. Baasha comes from a line which is not really. He's a breakaway. So you go and you have the rights to break the covenant with them. And Ben Adad was quite happy with this proposition. Very gladly took the northern lands of Israel. Right. So if you go back to that map for a second, that it's sort of this northern swath of land here, Dan, Chatzor. This area here was what Aram clearly took over. Very happy. Kinneret obviously sounds like Kinneret, so he's taking some of the banks. Oh, the Kinneret, the water crisis, if you remember back before the 1967 war. So that kind of thing is happening right now. So when Baasha hears about this, he retreats to Tirzah, which is his capital, and he no longer attacks the south because the north is under attack. So it sounds like a very nifty operation, but it's a very bad idea. When Jews call non-Jews to help in battles against other Jews, that's never a good thing for the Jews, no matter which side of the Jews you're on. That's never a good thing. You know, ultimately, you know, when it comes, if you do a fast forward to the times of the Chashmonaim, when their Malchus turned pretty sour, it was not a good time. What happened was there was an infighting war between Aristobulus and Hyrcanus, two of the different Hasmonean children who wanted a war, and there was a siege around the temple. One was inside, one was outside. I mean, terrible things that went on. They called in the Romans to help, and they said, you know, wouldn't you mind just, you know, they're traitors and you should get them. Well, that didn't work out so well. So it's not a good idea to involve other powers when it comes to internal battles. And this is what Asa is doing. And now we are reaping the fruit. So now we come back to our episode. And now we can understand why Ben-Hadad is here. There's been a long history of complexity. And he was invited in. Well, now he's coming back. Right? He's tasted what it's like to have a little bit of Israel. So he wants to have a little more. And therefore he makes his demands to Ahab. So it's a sad moment. It's really, this should be something which should be very, very sad to us. I do want to mention that if you do remember at the end of Perek Yud Tes, Eliyahu Anavi, after being dismissed, essentially, was told to make three appointments. And one of the appointments was Hazael, the king of Aram. That's not Ben-Hadad. So it's just interesting that there's a replacement set up. We have to think about why Ben-Hadad is important over here. Now, let's go back to the demands, right? So the demands he makes are for three things. He asks for Kasbuchos of Hoy, he wants his material wealth, and his wives and children, right? So that's what he's asking. Why is particularly these things? I mean, so this is sort of a demonstration of power, certainly, unfortunately, in those days, and unfortunately, in some parts of the world still today. But what does this actually mean? So the Malbim says that we should be thinking about this in terms of a message. Ahav's supposed to be reading between the lines here. So the Malbim quotes Chazal, and he says, Amru, Shemasha Kosov Kol Machmar Enecho. Oh, so we'll get back to that in a second, about the Sefer Torah in a second. He says, why? Ki mimitzvas hamelech shalo yirbe lo noshim v'lo kesef v'zahav. A king should not have too many wives or too much gold and silver. V'shichto mishnei Torah v'achav shomar lichtov lo Sefer Torah shezeh mitachsisem lucha. So Ahav had a Torah. So what's being said to you over here is that Malbim is pointing out is that things that he demands are particularly the things that the Torah says the king needs to be careful about, not over amassing. So not having too many relationships, not having too much gold and silver in his coffers. And the fact that ultimately that he's not doing that correctly, that's perhaps why it's being demanded here. So he's supposed to be reading that. Whether he does or not is another question. But essentially, this should be a message that he is reading very clearly here. Okay, let's go a little further now. So now we hear the next few psukim, and in the next few psukim we hear about the response of Ahav. So what would you do if you were in Ahav's shoes? I mean, you know, 32 kings and a large army is a pretty convincing proposition. On the other hand, the demands are pretty terrible, right? So like, well, what are you going to do in this situation? Not so simple. So how does he respond? One second. Okay, so here we go. Let's go back to the Pesukim. The Pesukim tell us, Vaya'an Melech Yisrael, Vayomer, very diplomatic, he says, Kidvarcho Adon Yamelech, L'cho Ani V'chol Asher Li, he says, oh, king, anything I have is yours, no problem whatsoever. So, so he essentially sounds like he cedes to all the details. You have to think to yourself, like, what is he doing? Okay, we'll come back to that in a moment. Vayashuvu malachim vayomru, ko amara ben hadad veymor, ki shalachti elecho leymor, kas b'cho zocho noshecho v'necho ti'li teiten. So let's just reiterate the terms of the deal, says ben hadad. I asked you that I can have your silver, gold, and wives and sons. Kiim kais mochar, then tomorrow, eshlach es avodai elecho v'chipsu es bezecho es botai avodecho v'hoyo akol machman einecho yosim b'yodon v'lokochu. So tomorrow this time, expect my servants to arrive, and they will take whatever it is that they want, anything they want, or anything that's important to you, they will take. Ooh. Okay, so Ben-Hadad takes this very literally, and he's sending them. Now, you should notice that these words, ki kais machar, this time tomorrow, should be a familiar type of phrase. The reason that it should be familiar is because those are almost the same words that were used by Izebel. Izebel, when she turned to Eliyahu Hanavi, what she said is, well, everything that is yours, I will. She says to Eliyahu, tomorrow I will kill you. So that should be a little bit of an echo as well. Again, there's sort of subtext messaging going on here. But he sounds like he really means business. So Vayikra Melech Yisrael calls Zignei Yaretz. So he now gathers together his council. Vayomed, ooh, no, ooh, ki ra zem vakesh. Like, this is not such a good thing. He's going to send his messages. It's not good. Kishalach elai lenoshay levanay lekaspi lezavi v'lo imanatu mimeni. And I didn't say no. So I'm in a bit of a pickle now. So vayimru elov kol hazakenim kol ha'am al tishma v'lo tovei. No. No, you cannot allow him in. That's not going to be allowed. And by the way, you notice that it's not just his council now, it's the kol ha'am. People say, oh, under no conditions can this occur. So Ahav responds, he says, what initially you requested, I can do. What you requested now, I cannot do. And they returned words to him. Okay, so let's just stop for a moment. Like, okay, so let's come back to that for a second. It sounds like Ahav is saying, request A, I accept. Request B, not happening. So, but to us, if we just read these psukim, it sounds like they're the same thing. He says, "Kas b'chazav chanoshecha v'ovanecha." He says, "Yes." Then he says, "Tomorrow I'm going to come collect everything." So, what's the difference? What changed in request two or tachlis two is the question. Also, another question we should be asking ourselves is like, why would Ahav say yes to that? I mean, you know, that's a pretty terrifying request. Like, why would he say yes? So let's look at the psukim carefully. So there are a few things to notice that are different. Okay, just in the actual words, and then perhaps another few suggestions. One extra difference over here is this extra phrase in Pasuk Vav where it says "V'eis botei avodecha." In the beginning, it was a personal sacrifice. But now it's no longer a personal sacrifice. It is anybody and anywhere. Meaning to say, you know, I'm going to send my crusaders in. You know, when the crusades were like, you know, when, you know, Richard the Lionheart, the Third Crusade, when they sent these folks out, a lot of them were people who were released from the prisons. You know what I'm saying? Like people who had real issues and the ways to exonerate themselves would be to go and, you know, kill people in the Holy Land and along the way. It wasn't exactly like your finest of society were, you know, we're going out wearing those white tunics and red crosses, right? It was the lowest of the low people had real histories of complex brutality. So, and that explains a lot of what they did along the way. It was, you know, in the name of God. So you know, when you say like that, that's essentially what's one of the differences is. Before it sounded like, okay, so it's a quid pro quo, you know, king to king. Now it sounds like, you know, I'll send my servants and they can do whatever they want. Well, that's a little too much. That's one thing which is a difference. Another difference in the psukim itself is this phrase, which is vayakol machmer enecho, everything which is dear to you. So before it was kesev zav nashecho vanecho, and now it is everything that's precious to you. That's interesting. So it sounds like now there's no upper limits, right? It can be anything which is precious to you is now game. That also could be another element to this. But still, even if this is the case, even if he's going, Ben-Hadad is being excessive in what's actually going to happen, it still doesn't explain to us how Achav would have allowed even the first request to be real. So, truth be told, the Mefarshim debate this greatly, and many of the Mefarshim say an interesting point, and that is, what did Achav conceive the first request to be? It wasn't as if he would just give up his wives and his children to this barbarian. No, what this actually he understood it to mean was that when he was demanding it, it was for tax purposes. Meaning to say, what he was saying was, I am the king of the north, I'm in charge of all this area, and how am I going to show that I'm in charge? Everybody pays me taxes. So your kingdom, your throne, everything that belongs to you, your children, they're all mine. So Achav says, yeah, I'm not going to argue with semantics. Tell me how much you want. I'll put on the credit card and we'll call it a day. That's what Achav says at the beginning. Then suddenly he gets a response and Ben-Hadad says, well, we'll be by you by tomorrow to collect everything. He says, not so fast. So you understand. So the perhaps what happened between part number one and part number two, this is as the Radak explains it, that Barbanel says it explains it, is that no. It was at the beginning, it was seen as a we'll call it a metaphoric control expressed in financial debt. And the second time when Ben-Hadad actually was going to send his folks, it meant actually Tachlis, and Achav says, I'm not going there. So that could be what's happening over here. And that's why he says, whatever you said first, I'll accept. But what you said second, I can't do. Right? So you meaning that's not all right. And by the way, Achav it can be understood for his misunderstanding, because after all, when Ben-Hadad comes in with his 32 kings, who are these 32 kings? It's not like they're all brothers and cousins. It means to say these are all the other folks already paying taxes to him, right? These are the other, you know, little fiefdoms all around that Aram is in control of. So Achav says, you want me to be a fiefdom? Okay. So your army is more powerful. I'll pay whatever it is that you need. And I'll be the 33rd king. But it sounds like Hadad has got a vendetta. And it's important to realize it's a big problem, especially in the male territory. You know, Ben-Hadad is not interested in money right now. He's interested in stamping down Israel into the mud. And so that's sort of like why this, he means this literally. But Achav thought that maybe this could be, right? Because if you think back to revenge and in the blood, and we have a history of being humiliated by Israel. So that's what's in Ben-Hadad's mind. In Achav's mind, it's okay. Unfortunately, times are tight. We're at the lower end of the fortune of the wheel of fortune. So we'll pay what we need to. Now, there is another explanation which is offered, and that is that word that we focused on before, and is kol machmar enecha, all that which is dear to you in your eyes. So that could mean just like to say is that anything you like, I'm going to take. That's what he means. But actually, it could be something specific. So the Chazal say, and the Malbim already cited this, is it was uidrash. What does it mean? Kol ma shetova berishana tova bershnia, chemda hu kesev zahav nashim bonim kulam chemda hem. They're all precious. Elamau kol machmar enecha. What is this? The phrase "all that which is dear in your eyes." Davar shu chemda mitoich chemda. It is more treasure than treasure. Beizezu. What is this? Zu haTorah. This is the actual scroll of the Torah. Hanechmadim mizahav mipazrav, which is more precious than stones. V'keivan sheshama melech Yisrael kach amar ein sheli. Hadavar hazeh. This does not belong to me to cede it to you. Shel zakeinimu. It belongs to the elders. Miyad vayikra melech Yisrael kol ziknei haaretz. So Chazal say, maybe you even can take it literally. Maybe beforehand he said, I'm going to take it, empty your coffers, and I'm going to take captive all your family. And maybe Achav felt he was forced to do this, or otherwise it would be a suicide battle. But when he says, when you take the Torah, I can't do that. That's the way Chazal looks at this dialogue. In fact, if you remember the Malbim we just looked at a second ago, the Malbim says that this is what he was demanding. That's the Torah itself. So he should write a Torah. And Achav wrote a Torah because that's what, you know, kings in Israel do, even though he wasn't particularly interested in reading it or following it. But then when he says that he's going to take the Torah, that's when he says, so why was Achav so concerned about the Torah going? So the Malbim interprets it by saying, because that's the symbol of the king. The Jewish king holds the Torah. So if the Torah is being taken, it's kind of like his crown. So he's saying that's too far. That's just such a humiliation, right? That's maybe what it is. Another way of looking at it, not like the way of the Malbim, is a very beautiful idea to be found in the Panine Halacha, which is a sefer put out by the Yeshivat Har Bracha. Har Bracha is a beautiful mountaintop yeshuv, which overlooks the holy city of Shechem in Israel. I had the opportunity of spending a Shabbos there, where a friend of mine was in Kollel. Very, very beautiful, beautiful place. It's exceptionally beautiful. They wrote a sefer called Panine Halacha, and it talks about Ha'am Va'aretz, the nation and the land, and they said a very beautiful thing here. And that is the following. He says, "V'chaim esupar shekasher ben Adad melech Aram negavara la'avetzar avetzar al Shomron." So ben Adad is besieging Shomron. Tovim imen lo says lo es kaspoy ve'zavoy ve'es nashav yeladav. He made all these demands. V'achav shechoshav she'avdu sikuyav le'natzeh bekrav. He realized that he would lose in battle. U'kenichna v'yiskim lo says es ha'ishayach lo ba'ofen ishi le'melech Aram. He said, "You know, I have to give everything that's mine to the king of Aram." Ulam kasher hosif ben Adad lidrosh es machmar enav ubiur chachomav chachomenu and chachom that the Gemara in Sanhedrin explains she can also also say v'tara lo yiskim. He could not agree. Hakovod haleumi, this we'll call it national pride. Shehis patei bekovod sefer Torah shehu neches leumi mekudash, which is the property of the holy nation. Haya yakar beinav kolkach ad sheheediv latzeis lekrav ibud. So, Achav is sort of like this person who, yes, you can humiliate me, you can take everything of mine, but to divest Israel of what it means to be Israel, that is too far. And therefore, they call him, essentially, the way they call him is, he was a person who had this regesh le'umi. He had this national emotional connection of honoring the Torah, even though he wasn't an observer of Torah. You know, when I grew up in South Africa, and South Africa is a very traditional place. And so you have lots of Lithuanians, and even though many of them, when they arrived off the boat in the 1900s, their children were certainly not Shomrei Torah Mitzvahs, but there was a great resurgence, the return to Torah. And part of that was as a function of the fact that in South Africa, there was rare, not very much of a reform or conservative movement of Torah, meaning of Judaism. The Jews who were not observant would drive to shul on Friday night to an Orthodox shul, right? So they didn't create their own religion like reform and conservative Judaism did, throwing off axioms of faith left, right, and center, and sort of recreating as they felt that it was appropriate to them based on the new reality. No, they didn't observe. They were non-observant, but they were Orthodox non-observant. Very, by the way, very similar to a lot of like Iranians, a lot of Syrians. They're very traditional. They don't create their own new systems like the Jews in America did. Unfortunately, a lot of the first immigrants to America were Jews from Germany who already were bringing reform with them, so that when the Russian less educated Jews came in, they didn't have the schools. They fell in. It's a long and complicated system in America, which is why we are where we are today. But what's being said over here is that Achav was not an observant person by any standard. Right, he was the king of Israel. He introduced Baal worship into Israel. But nonetheless, when you were to say we're going to take the Torah out of Israel, that was too far. That was too much. He still had that sense that this was illegitimate. That's who he was. I think that's a very beautiful way of reading this, and it also explains the complexity of who Achav is. It's not like he was a rotten person. He was a bad king in many respects, but he was also a good king in many respects as well. Now, let's go into the battle itself. So we stand at this point now, the cusp of the battle. Vayishlach ben Adad elav ben Adad vayomer koyasoni elokim koyasifu yispoik afar shomron leshalim lechol ha'am asher beraglai. So he uses this image, and he says, this is his image. He says, there's not enough dust in Samaria that if you're to pick up every handful of dust, for there to be enough dust to fill all the hands of my soldiers. Meaning to say, I have so many soldiers, you don't even have enough sand to put in their hands. That's kind of his image of how powerful he is. So he says, meaning to say, you insect, I'm going to crush you. You have nothing you can do to stand up to me. That's essentially what he's saying to Achav. So Achav responds also with a beautiful idiom, which I'm not sure why is not more popular. This is a very beautiful idiom and quotation. Vayad Melech Yisrael vayomer dabru. He says, tell Ben Adad, al yisalel choger kamafteach. Don't be so excited as you put on your sword. as when you take it off. Meaning to say, it's all very nice to, you know, to be so excited before you go into battle. Start rejoicing when you come out of battle. Don't be so sure of yourself, even though he knows the odds are not in his favor. Okay, so two images or two idioms being you know, this is a psychological warfare which is starting before the battle, and this is what this is how it starts. Okay. So at this point in time, Ben-Hadad is like, you know, in his tents, and he's like, you know, busy drinking. And he says, you know, you guys, you know, get ready for the battle, right? You know, like, he's like, this is not much of a concern to him. You know, there's not going to be too much fortification that he has to fight through. Sukkos does not mean a place. It means to say that's the tents, the booths they were staying in. Sukkos is actually a city, but that's found on Transjordan East. That's not where he is right now. So a prophet of Hashem comes to him, and it's not told to us who he is, and he says the following. He says, Hashem says to you, if you look out, your window and see how many people, how many folks they have over there, he says, I'm going to give them all to you. Part of the reason why he says, look at them, is because, just understand, it's not that they have a small army. It's not that they are disorganized. They have a very big army. So understand that what's about to happen is going to be miraculous. That's what is being told to him. So this is this conversation. By whom? By the young men, the princes of the provinces. Who's going to lead the battle? He says, you. So two questions, right? By me and me, Esar. So he gathers together the princes of the provinces. So that's a sum total of 232 soldiers. Again, that doesn't sound like a grand army right now. But after them, he put Pokad as Kol Ha'am, Kol Beis Bnei Yisrael, Shiva Zvavim, puts together 7,000 soldiers. Whether that's the 7,000 soldiers representing the city of Shamron, I have to think about that number 7,000. Should be ringing a bell for us too. So in the meantime, at this point, the camera pans now back to the booths of Ben-Hadad, and he is completely drunk, you know, mid-afternoon. I guess instead of coffee these days, it was just more wine, and everybody is drunk. So he now, the watchmen say, Ben-Hadad, we noticed that there's been a band of people leaving Shamron, and they're coming to us. He says, if they're coming for peace, just capture them alive. And if they're coming for war, just, you know, capture them alive. He switches the order. The Mefarshim talk about why he switches the order. But basically, he's going to torture whoever it is publicly. You know, so this, as the Mefarshim point out, and, you know, he's not very concerned about this. So they come with this army behind them. So they slew every person slew his man. So whether that means to say 7,232 people were killed, but this battle ensues. By your defending Israel, by Molay Ben Adad, Melech Aram, Al Sus Uprashim, and he has to run. He has to seek refuge with his chariots. By Yisrael, Melech Israel, by Yach Es Asus Vesarecha VeYikob Aram Hakadolan. There was a large slaying of those from Aram. By Yigash Anavi Al Melech Israel, by Yomer Loi. The Navi returns to him and says, you need to be careful. In a year's time, Aram is going to come back to you. You need to prepare yourself. Okay. So this is the first battle, the success of the first battle. So what is interesting over here is that the first thing is that the Navi is clouded. We don't know who the Navi actually is. Interesting. So why don't we know who it is? So the one thing we should know is that it is not Eliyahu. How do we know that? Because Eliyahu has been dismissed, right? Eliyahu is no longer, he's now replacing Elisha, being replaced by Elisha. So you say, well, maybe it's Elisha. But Elisha's still in training, as is evident from the next few prakim. So actually, Seder Olam Rabbah, which Rashi quotes over here, Seder Olam is the Midrash to Taman Perkhov, quotes the following. Here we are. In the sources, he says, Navi Echad, hu Michayahu ben Yimala. So this is Michayahu. Okay, here's the Navi who comes out of here. So it's a separate, independent Navi. And now the question is does Achav actually believe him? So from the conversation that he has, does it sound like he believes him? Because you should note that the Pesukim are not saying this is a Navi Elohim, right? This is of Hashem as Elohim as expressing himself as a God, as power. It is Navi Hashem, Yudke Vavke. That's the more, we'll call it, you know, intentional name of HaKadosh Baruch Hu above the system, not just within the system. So he gives him this prophecy. Well, let's look at the questions he asks. The questions he asks are, here we are. So the questions he asks are, by me, and who's going to be the soldiers and who's going to lead the soldiers? Those are the two questions he asks. So those two questions do give us an indication that he does believe, right? It does sound like he believes this to a certain degree. So the Baradel says he does. In fact, not only does he believe, he realizes his own inadequacy. Because remember, here is a king who's got a very bad track record of spiritual success. Vine Achav, in the Baradel says in source 12, Vine Achav im kol rishasoi hemin b'divrei hanavi. He may have been a wicked king, but he still believed the prophet. Okay, coming back to the point beforehand, that he wouldn't see the Sefer Torah. He still believes the prophet. And even though he disobeys the Navi, did you notice that? The Navi said, send the Sare, the Nare, Nare Anasiim. Right? Or the Nare, what's the word over here? It is Nare. Right? The children of the princes of the countries. He puts 7,000 soldiers behind him, almost as if he does not believe the battle can successfully be won just by the Na'arim. So even though he disobeys the Navi, why did he do that? V'ulai hayuheim asher zachar shloi karu labal v'kol aper asher loi nashakla. If you remember the end of Perek Yotes, Hashem promises that there's going to be retributions that is going to be visited upon Israel, and through Hazael, and through Yehu, and through Elisha, and the only people who are going to survive are 7,000 people who did not bow down to Baal in the land of Israel. So what is he doing? So he's taking those people. Achav realizes that the miracle can only come through the conduit of those who really served him. So he finds those who served Hashem, even though he himself introduced Baal worship and Avodah Zarah into the north to a large degree. He realized that he was wrong. That's why he asks who should lead it, this war effort. So the reason why he asks that is because he thinks to himself, well, maybe I'm not worthy to be the captain of this or the general of this battalion, because I am, in fact, am a sinner. So in his words, you see already that Achav is sort of knows the scorecard. He understands spiritually where he is. That's amazing, right? You very rarely meet a king in Tanakh, like in the later days of Israel, unfortunately, who has this degree of self-awareness, which sort of contributes to this complexity as Achav as the king. Now, who are these Sarei Hamedinos? So Rashi says, who are they? Hem b'nei hataravois shayu kol ha'sarim shal shara umos nosnim b'neihem tachas yodai arevim shalo yimradu boi. So this means to say that, let's say Israel had relationships with other neighboring countries, Ammon, Edom, other folks around. The practice was the ruling society would take the children of the neighboring vassal states and educate them and look after them. Why? Not just because they're the best international school in the Middle East, also but because they were collateral, arevim, shalayim redubay. Let's say Ammon decides to rebel against Israel. Israel would use the children of the king of Ammon as collateral against them. We're going to see this later on at the beginning of Melachim Aleph. We see this happens with Moab and Edom. This is going to happen later on in history. It's interesting that actually Antiochus the Fourth, who was the Antiochus of Hanukkah, in fact he was the Arev. He was the brought up in Rome as a collateral against the Greeks. A lot of interesting things. This is a practice. This is who it is. Why is he choosing them? So Radak says is simply because they're easily at hand, meaning to say you don't have to go searching and conscription and just take the kids out of school and that's how you'll win the battle, to show you how miraculous it is going to be as well. So this is what happens now. One of the questions that's worthwhile thinking about over here, and I think it's really a essential question over here, is that this last statement that the Navi makes. He speaks to him before the battle, you're going to win this battle. Then after the battle, he comes back to him and he says, you should strengthen yourself, right? So he tells him, what's the words he uses at the end of the battle? He says, Vayomer lo lech his chazek, go and strengthen yourself, right? So why is he telling him this? So the Mefarshim explain this in different ways, but the Malim says, Lech Yischazek, Omalai, Ato Nitzachta Al Pines. He says, now this was a miraculous battle by all standards, right? The size of the army, the size of your army, the who is fighting in the army, no chances you are winning this. Amal da, you should know. That time, in a year's time, when it's going to happen again, there will not be a miracle. Therefore, be very careful to make sure you prepare for war. And so therefore, this is a physical demonstration of a preparation. The Radak says, a little bit of a different, say, a different perspective. He says, Upirush, the second Upirush, and the second Pirush, his chazek b'maasim tovim, la'akor avoras gilulim. You need to prepare yourself for battle. You now know that Hashem is God and He's the all powerful one. You now need to take advantage and create the spiritual reformation. Meaning to say, you want to talk about this, in different terms. What just happened over here was on credit. You didn't deserve it. So that being the case, if it was on credit, well, now you need to earn it. How are you going to earn it? Work to fix yourself up so that in a year's time, when it happens for real, you'll be worthy of it spiritually, that it won't be on credit. I think that this is a great metaphor for our lives. You know, the way that is generally understood is that we're born on credit. You know, I mean, to say Hashem gives us this gift of life, and we have no credentials yet and we have no achievements yet to put onto the resume to saying that we deserve to be alive by any chance. Hashem says, it's on credit. Sorry, I made an investment in you. And I'm sure that over time, the investment will pay itself off. So that's really what's happening over here, is that I'm making an investment in you, Achav, and let's see if you're going to do it. Are you going to create the spiritual reform, or are you going to do what's necessary to get there or not? Which kind of leads us to a very fascinating question, which the Radak is essentially answering. And that is why should he win the war, right? Baal, Et Baal, Asherah, Izebel, you know, persecuting Eliyahu. I mean, that's all bad stuff. So why does he have the rights to win this battle? So the Radak would answer is, he doesn't. It's on credit, right? So it's really about the future, right? I'm investing in you. The other way that it's looked at over here is on a more obscure and more sad way of looking at it is, and this is what Rabbi Benel says, a very sad statement. He made this war happen for a number of reasons. Achas la'achas, bein Adam ubein Aram Yisrael, eva rabo v'sina muflegas. There's a very deep and dark history between Israel and Aram, as we saw before. What's happening over here is Hashem is actually allowing Israel to win to make the animosity grow, so that now when they come back later on, they're going to be even more angry. The shenius. Another reason is Kadesh Yisrael Yiru Beinayim. They're going to see that Hashem is miraculous and Khalid. So that's a lesson from the inside. As you see from these two wars, we're going to see the second war soon. He says, now take a look at this. So listen to this. And the reason why he was allowed to be the leader of this battle, even though he himself was not spiritually worthy, was that so that he would become the target and the face of Israel for later battles. And we're going to fast forward in 2 Parakim, where they're going to essentially have a search and destroy campaign just against Achav. And that is because he becomes the face of it. So on the one hand, it is good, and it's giving him an opportunity, and it's a spiritual success. On the other hand, it's also going to come back to haunt him later on. That's what the Rabbi Benel is saying. Very sad. And finally, this is a famous Yerushalmi in Peah, Perek Dalet, which I'm sure we've heard before, but it's now putting things into context. The Gemara is comparing the differences between the wars of David HaMelech and the wars of Achav, and it says there were casualties in the wars of David, but there was no casualties, or there was success in the wars of Achav. Why? Why was that? Aval darosh al Achav oved avod azara hayu. They served avod azara. Al yedei shaloi haya kohen loi haya lahem daily torin hayu yordan imelcham avanotzkim. Because they did not have daily torin. What's daily torin? That means slander. They did not have slander, therefore they succeeded in battle. Well, that's what Avadia says to Eliyahu. Just to summarize the rest of this Gemara, this Talmud Yerushalmi, Avadia says, I harbored all these prophets in the cave, if you remember back to Perek Yud Zayin, and they were being persecuted by Yezebel. So when Eliyahu appears on Har Kamal, he says, Ani levadino sarti, navi la Hashem. I was the only one who was a prophet remaining to Hashem. And the Yerushalmi darshans, what that means to say is that to the credit of the people, I was this person. I should have been prosecuted and persecuted, and nobody gave me in because they respected Hashem. So that means to say that that was a credit to the people that they would not tell, they would not slander Eliyahu, even though it was complex times and there was a large reward in Israel ostensibly. So what the Talmud Yerushalmi is saying is that despite the spiritual, we'll call it Ben Adam Lemakom, the spiritual ritual problems they had in that channel, the horizontal plane, Ben Adam Lechavera, was actually pristine. And that actually was a protecting agent. It doesn't mean to say that you can exonerate yourself through being nice. You know, I'll steal millions of dollars and give tzedakah. That does not exactly what's being said here. What it's been saying is that despite the fact that they had a great spiritual demerit, ultimately they could protect themselves while there was no daily Torah. But if there is daily Torah, if there is slander, there's complexity in society, then that stands as a very negative. A negative way of, and perhaps an easier way to get into a deeper and darker place much faster. Okay, so this is.